Minda Bruce is a person of action. When she sees a problem, she does what she can to fix it. But when COVID-19 hit and she, like most of us, went on lockdown, Minda was at a loss. How could she help all these families suddenly weathering a financial crisis? How could she patch the holes in governmental assistance? So Minda, co-founder of First Row Partners, a venture firm, got to work. Over the last 6 weeks, yes, just 6 weeks, she has co-founded and launched the 1K Project, which matches families in need with peers willing to provide $1,000 a month for 3 months. This week, we talk about stepping up and stepping in, even when it feels messy, even when it feels like a drop in the bucket. I'm Claudia Reuter, and this is the third season of The 43%. Hi, Minda. Thanks so much for joining The 43%. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
I was wondering if we could actually kick off by, you know, if someone were to ask you, who are you, how would you answer that?
I think if I were to meet someone professionally, I would say that I recently launched a small venture firm and I'm really excited to grow that. I would also right now be talking about the 1K project that I co-founded about 6 weeks ago, which was, a real surprise to be doing something that new and big all at once, but it's become a really important side project to me. So I think that those are sort of the two things. I think I also always like to talk about my family. And so I'm the mom of two kids, twins, Holly and Wyatt, who are 15 years old.
You mentioned that you just started a new project. What compelled you to start this new initiative?
I think that, like a lot of people, when the initial shelter-in-place order happened, you know, we were looking for ways to help and feeling really helpless because, unlike in other times, there was no place to go and help in a traditional sense. I couldn't go fill sandbags anywhere. I couldn't go work at a food bank. I was talking to my business partner, Yoko. We were really challenged to try and figure out, you know, who are we during this crisis? And so much of who we are as professionals and as individuals is that we're always raising our hand to help. And whatever room we're in the front row raising our hand and engaging. It was a conversation with our friend and fellow investor that really helped us hone in on the fact that what was happening is that people were not getting help fast enough. And so as we started thinking about what we could do that was immediate and direct, but that also could scale to impact, because I think as someone in technology, we're always looking to take something, do something, and then make it bigger so that more people can participate. So the idea of the sense of urgency for families needing immediate cash assistance really resonated with both of us as our purpose in this crisis.
Yeah. And it's amazing how quickly you've managed to pull this together. Can you share a little bit more about sort of the mechanics of it? Like, how does it work?
Yeah. So I think of it as like a matchmaking service in a lot of ways. If you're an individual that can support someone with $1,000 a month for 3 months, and you have that capacity and you want to help, and you want to help a specific person, how do you find that person? And so what we did is we thought about how quickly could we bring people together in that sense, finding someone who had those funds and finding someone who really needed those funds. There are a lot of ways where we could have just broadcast out to the world, hey, we have this opportunity to have people give you money, and we would have been probably flooded with applications, but really not knowing how to screen and verify people. And so that became our first thought process. And then what we realized is that in human, in a small scale, on a human scale, what we do is we know each other, and we know each other through trusted networks of who we know, and that might be something that we could scale. And so what we did is we decided to map out a network of trusted connections that went well beyond our personal connections, and to architect that and map that out in such a way that it became a way to have verification of a person come through really quickly, where we could very easily give them a lightweight application, have them tell us their story, and then present their story to a potential sponsor. So really the first part was figuring out how could we bring in and verify families through this network effect, network approach. And then on the other side, how could we connect them? And so what we did is we put a GoFundMe page in the middle, because one of the other things is that we're not a nonprofit. We're a volunteer collective. And we didn't want to get in the middle of taking payment from sponsors and then turning around and giving it to people. So we realized that by putting someone's story and anonymizing it and putting it on a GoFundMe page, we could present that information to a sponsor who then trusted us that we had found a person and verified them such that they could make a direct donation right then and there. And so we are this matchmaking service between these sponsors and these families where they don't have to know each other in detail, but they know each other in a connection sense, that they are all part of the same network.
And how many families have you positively impacted through this volunteer collective so far?
We're up to about 240 families of this afternoon. And those are families who are being funded at, you know, $3,000 each, $1,000 a month for 3 months. So we found that that was a really significant and meaningful amount that enabled someone to really bridge over to some sort of new job, new employment opportunity, changing their circumstances or getting some other help. We weren't designed to be sort of a forever solution. We were really thinking of this as a bridge, but a meaningful bridge. Because if someone had to cobble together lots of different opportunities at $100, $200, $300 each, that's exhausting. And what we needed to get them help quickly and in a meaningful way, because they were facing, you know, not being able to buy food, not being able to pay the utilities. And we needed to make sure that that was a meaningful and sufficient amount.
As you're thinking about what's next, I mean, there's so much uncertainty still on exactly when the world is going to come back to normal. And a lot of the people who have unfortunately lost their jobs are still in industries where we're not entirely sure when some of these industries are going to be coming back. Have you thought or have been able to think a little bit more about what happens next? Like, where do these financial bridges go from here? Or what are some of the tools that allow people to, you know, re-enter the workforce depending on what's going on?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that as we're hitting sort of the six week, 8 week mark, we start thinking about, you know, we're helping with this immediate need, but how long will we be needed and relevant? And our hope is that we become completely irrelevant and unneeded, but that's probably not realistic anytime soon. But what we do hope is that there will be sufficient, you know, mobilization of large nonprofit organizations and government that can be those support structures, and that the social safety net can start to address and meet the needs of these new entrants. We would love to be irrelevant. We don't know that we will be, but we are always looking to collaborate and work with other people who are working on similar projects and sort of try and understand that. I think one of the important things that we have done is not jump to conclusions about anything we need to do on a permanent basis. You know, we didn't run out and start a nonprofit. We found a fiscal sponsor. We've kept ourselves organized in what we call sort of a creative chaos, which I think is actually a positive thing, not a negative thing, in that we know that in order to move quickly, we need to be nimble and fast. And a certain amount of chaos creates the speed and momentum that we've really relied on. And so we've really structured ourselves in that way so that everyone involved with the project is able to be a doer and a builder. We really are architected for that immediate and fast action and not as a permanent group. So, you know, we just don't know yet is the real answer. But as we get further along, we do have to start thinking about that.
Yeah, no. And I love how you were just describing this idea of like the organized chaos. Can you share a little bit more about that? I think a lot of people, when you think about putting together any initiative, whether it's a new technology offering or new cause like this, you know, people kind of see in their head like, oh, there's a project plan and everyone's lining up to get to a certain date when we're going to have this certain outcome. Can you share a little bit more about what you mean by the way in which you structured things to allow for chaos and to allow for, you know, fast movement?
Alex and I both come from entrepreneurial backgrounds, having started companies, founded things, worked in the startup scene. And so I think that our comfort in ambiguity and chaos comes from that. And so we're able to be comfortable in those environments, bringing new people in and leading and constantly learning and changing and having that be an okay thing. And that we know that overly siloing and creating processes can bring things to a grinding halt. So we're comfortable, you know, building out scripts and clarity of communication. When we figure something out, we'll document it and share it and make it available and communicate it really, you know, clearly and consistently. But we're always looking to learn and enabling people to go and try things that might fail. Like I'll never forget one day when Alex tried something on Facebook that was sort of an experiment and it went horribly wrong. He just sort of hit the wrong audience with the wrong kind of message out there in terms of what he was communicating. And he realized really quickly he had to dial back. But we wanted that. We wanted people to sort of sense an idea, move on it, try it, and tell us what they thought. So that rapid iteration was possible because there was sort of free permission given. And so that communicating that from Alex's and my perspective every day, all the time, as we work with people and talk about what we're going to be doing, we say, here's the process flow. Here's the outline. Here's the document. But go try this and tell us what's not working or what is wrong with this. So we're just constantly, you know, trying to break down any sense of hierarchy and empower people to contribute and participate their own superpowers and really respect those contributions. And then it's our job to sort of assemble what's working. That's this wonderful discovery leadership process that you get to do when you're in a tech startup, is our experience. And so bringing that to this has enabled us to move just super quick. And we also, just from a technology perspective, work on a very low code, no code kind of stack. So we didn't spend too much time building a lot of code and websites and systems. Instead, we really focused on how can we be helping a family and learning what systems we need to support that along the way. So we sort of build the plane as we flew it. And I think it just takes having done that before to be comfortable doing it that way. Our urgency and our mission is about getting families funded quickly. And so when we keep orienting people around that, it really keeps everyone thinking in the same direction and free to contribute.
You guys know me. I'm a working mom. I make a podcast about working moms. Tons of my friends are working moms, and busy doesn't even begin to cover it. So when it comes to grocery shopping, we need fast. We need streamlined. We need one place where we can buy bacon for the husband who's paleo and soy cheese for the kid who's vegan. Thrive Market checks all of those boxes. Thrive Market is an online membership-based market on a mission to make healthy living easy and affordable for everyone. Get the app and skip the store and the lines. You can buy thousands of wholesome food, home, and beauty products curated just for members. Find everything you need, organic and non-GMO food, clean beauty, safe supplements, and non-toxic home, plus ethical meat, sustainable seafood, clean wine, and more. Easily shop by over 70 diets and values like keto, paleo, gluten-free, vegan, non-GMO, fair trade certified, and BPA-free. Plus, Thrive Market's members' prices are 25 to 50% lower than traditional retail prices, and they stay that way. Thrive Market is 100% committed to never engaging in surge pricing. You'll find the same member-only savings no matter what. Thrive Market also gives back, which is another reason to feel good when shopping with them. Their COVID-19 Relief Fund provides grocery stipends to families facing health or financial hardships due to COVID-19. Thrive Market and partners have collectively raised more than $400,000 so far. Go to thrivemarket.com/43% to give Thrive Market a try. You can choose the membership model that best fits your lifestyle. They have 1 month and 12 month options. When you go to thrivemarket.com/43%, you can receive up to $20 in shopping credit when you join today. That's thrivemarket.com/43%. thrivemarket.com/43%. Are you afraid to color your hair at home? Believe me, I was too. But it's hard to make the time for regular salon visits in between juggling kids and work responsibilities. And the last time I colored my hair at home, well, Let's just say I started wearing a lot of hats. But Madison Reed's at-home hair color is different. This new color has me feeling good, feeling confident, feeling unstoppable. I just learned that Madison Reed was named after their founder, Amy Arad's daughter. Amy wanted Madison to grow up believing that a beautiful woman is a confident woman. And confident women, we can change the world. I really mean that. I mean, hey, that's why I started this podcast. Madison Reed hair color is made with stuff you can actually feel good about. It's full of ingredients that nourish your hair. Their products are infused with argan oil, keratin, and ginseng root extract, so you get shiny, healthy-looking hair color. Madison Reed makes it so easy to find your perfect shade. You just take the color quiz, answer a few questions, and they recommend the shades that are best for you. Whether it's covering stubborn grays or freshening up your look with a new color, there are over 55 gorgeous colors you can try on. My match? Smoky medium blonde. Even the name is fun. It's also super convenient. Madison Reed delivers right to your door on your schedule. You can do your own hair on your own time in under an hour in the comfort of your own home. Get multi-dimensional hair color delivered right to your door at madison-reed.com. Use my promo code 43 and you'll get 10% off plus free shipping on your first color kit. My promo code again is the number 4 and the number 3. That's 43. Visit madison-reed.com now to find your perfect shade. That's madison-reed.com. Can you kind of take us back? You're doing all these amazing things. How did you get here? What was your journey from, you know, young college graduate to today?
I think as a young college graduate, I already had a lot behind me in terms of entrepreneurial energy and some experiences that made me really prepared for the entrepreneurial life. I happened to graduate in the mid-90s in the Bay Area from college, which was a fantastic place to be. And the timing was really fortuitous. And I had the opportunity to work in consulting where everything I jumped into was like a fire hose of new information, learn a new industry, learn this emerging software, build this new team together and race toward these deadlines and get things done. And I really responded to that. So even though it was corporate consulting, it was in this really rapid iterating environment with a lot of new software, new ideas and technology at the forefront. So doing that prepared me to get into my first startup, which was during the 99 sort of dot-com boom in San Francisco. So I just think that I'm attracted to that sort of catalyst role, and I enjoy that burst of energy that comes from getting a group of people together, sort of working in this creative chaos in order to do something really specific and accomplish a goal. And that sense of urgency is something that really motivates me.
So you start out in consulting, you get into startup landscape. Where did kids figure into all of this?
Well, my mom will tell you that my first business plan at 13 was to have my own business by the time I was 40. And I had a very detailed plan. And she said, well, are you ever going to have kids or a husband? And I was like, oh, I hadn't thought about that part. So I was, I came out of my undergraduate experience ready to just hit the road and go. You know, I think I said to the consulting group that I was working for, I was like, send me to the most interesting project wherever it is. I just want to be thrown in to the most challenging work that I can find. And I really had that high motivation and intensity. I think I was dating my now husband and found out that I had type 1 diabetes when I was 25. That was a real shock that my body let me down. And so I had to really adjust to a new normal. And over the course of a couple of years, realized that I wasn't going to be able to travel extensively and intensively like I had. And I was not able to sort of have my body be sacrificed. I had to really pay attention to what was going to come next for me and how was I going to map out the next 15, 20 years. So I think that was the first time that I really ever stopped to think about it.
For folks, myself included, who don't know a lot about type 1 diabetes, what led you to realize like there was some challenge here that was going to make you reassess, how you were working and how that related to your health?
Yeah. So it was the course of a few months of, you know, increasing number of what seemed like random symptoms of blurry vision and extreme thirst and intense cravings for sugar. And I went in with all of these symptoms, and it was a really fast diagnosis because there are very few things that sort of line up to those symptoms. And what that meant was, is I was immediately put on insulin. And insulin is a wonderful thing, but, you know, your whole body chemistry changes when you're body no longer is able to produce enough insulin. And so you're sort of manually taking over dosing yourself with insulin every day and balancing that with food intake. And so there was a huge learning curve in terms of how to manage life with insulin and taking shots and doing all these new things. But, you know, over the course of those first, you know, that first year, I was learning the mechanics of how to take care of it. But then my doctor was really observant of the fact of what my lifestyle was. And she said, you know, you'll be able to do this. You'll be able to take the shots and you'll be able to, you know, manage your blood sugars. And there are highs and lows that can make you feel not very good at any given moment. She's like, you can do that. You'll manage it. But your body will never be the same as everybody else's in terms of what it can endure and take. So the extensive travel and changing time zones and really always putting a client first. She said, if I could prescribe a career change for you, I would. And that just really hit me hard. Being told at age 25, 26 that like my ambition needed to be reshaped and I was going to have to find a different way forward than what I had been doing. And it was really frustrating.
What went through your head to think about and how did you take the steps to know what was next?
Yeah, I did a lot of learning and education just to sort of get an understanding of how to operate in this environment. And that just took some natural time. My husband was incredibly supportive right from the get-go. And I think that that told me a lot about who he is and why that was probably the right person for me. So that sort of accelerated things, I think, on that front. And I also realized that if my body was going to be sort of put under strain from this chronic condition, that I needed to think carefully about when I was going to have kids and that I was going to need to really plan that out sooner rather than later, is sort of how I immediately felt. And so I really launched into planning my sort of family life, I think, at that time and making sure that that was going to happen and be possible for me. Whereas before, I'd been able to sort of kick the can and defer it until this abstract idea that I would have, you know, this something big by age 40, and then I could turn around and sort of create a family life for myself. That wasn't going to be, that was no longer sort of the path that I was going to be able to take. Now, I don't know that I would have, but this certainly changed it. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely think it's so easy for all of us to kind of walk around with a narrative that these things come easily and you just decide when you're ready and I'll push it off till then. But there, you know, there's very real health implications along the way for everybody. And then when you throw in something like this, I mean, that's a huge obstacle to overcome. Were you working when you decided, when you actually had the kids, or did you take
them along? I was, yeah. So I joined my first startup in San Francisco in 99, and I spent 5 years there. It was 5 amazing, wonderful years. When I found out I was having twins, it was a point in my life where I decided that I really wanted to be a full-time parent at home. And that was just a really deliberate choice between me and my husband. I never really tried to make it work economically to go back to work, but certainly with twins, the idea of paying for infant childcare for twins puts a lot of twin parents having to have one parent stay home. It just economically doesn't always work. So I knew that I would have to go back to a job that was a really high paying job. And I thought, well, you know, is that a trade-off I really want to make where I'm really, you know, again, in a high pressure career role, and then I have these two young infants. And so we were just in a place where I was able to take that time. And so I, you know, threw myself into full-time parenthood of, you know, being at home with the kids.
How long did that go on?
I would say it went on for 5 years. And that is when I sort of hit a point where I realized that I needed more, because as the kids got to be about 2, 3, and 4, something that for me, every time I go through something or learn something, I like to turn around and teach it. And so as I learned twin parenthood, I realized that I could play a leadership role in my community by turning around and teaching it to new and expectant parents. And so I developed a really deep connection in the twin parent community here in Seattle, and was able to lead groups and facilitate things and organize parents in a way that was really meaningful to me. And what I came to realize by the time the kids were age 5 and I was taking on these volunteer leadership roles is that what I was also really craving was that professional life again. And so I first found it through volunteer leadership, which was an amazing find that I might not have been able to do if I had been in a paid working role. I was able to really professionalize my volunteer work. But I did realize that I wanted to go back and do more. So I started looking for opportunities that had flexibility built into them. And startups, you know, was something that I loved, and it seemed like a natural place to start again. And so I co-founded a small media business with my brother-in-law. So that was sort of my path back in.
I'm curious at your thoughts on, you know, with this pandemic and suddenly everybody's at home and babies are everywhere on Zoom calls. Is this the right time to rethink how we approach caregiving and what it means to be a member of a family in our society right now? To me, it seems like a great time to rethink things a bit.
Absolutely. And I'm realizing that I have 2 teenagers who don't need immediate supervision and don't crawl on my lap during conference calls and need constant attention. There is a penalty being paid by parents of very young children. Their lives are just not the same. Their contributions are different. Their time schedules are different. And then, you know, their colleagues that don't have small children are in a really different position in terms of what their work from home experience is like. So I think there's an unseen penalty in all this work from home, where everyone's situation is so different in terms of how many rooms you have, how much help you have, how old your children are. Of course, there's an opportunity now to like really think about how we restructure our lives coming out of this. So I'm very interested in the innovation that's happening and some of the tech startups going on with different ways of delivering childcare and who can deliver childcare and where it can be delivered. I'm really curious to see, as we go back to quote normal, just how many of those things will sort of recede into the background and which ones will really still be open for change and question. Because a lot of it really, when something new comes about, really there has to be the right time. And yeah. So I'm hopeful that there is sort of the right time for some real innovation, but I think it's to be seen as to how much really we're willing to change permanently.
That's it for this episode of the 43%. We'll be back next week with another conversation with an inspiring woman. If you could take just a minute to rate and review the podcast wherever you're listening, I'd really appreciate it. Thanks again. The 43% is produced by me, Claudia Reuter, Maddie Foley, and the entire team at Wonder Media Network. Our executive producer is Jenny Kaplan. You can follow Wonder Media on Twitter at WMNmedia and on Instagram at WMN.media. I'm on Twitter too, at Reuter_Claudia. You can also learn more about each episode at www.the43%.com. Talk to you next week, and thanks again for listening.